Today, we're going to take you through what is happening in India. It is absolutely devastating and tragic, and I want to warn you straight away that this is not one for younger ears, and there are descriptions within this piece that some listeners may find distressing. Hannah Ellis-Peterson, this is a tough time to be covering India for The Guardian. Tell me what it's like right now.
It's really hard to actually convey how terrible it feels on the ground here. People are dying in their droves, in hospitals, outside of hospitals, on the steps of hospitals because they can't get in, they can't get beds. There isn't enough oxygen to support the patients that are in the hospitals. There isn't enough oxygen for the patients who are coming in ambulances. There isn't enough drugs to treat the patients that are coming in with COVID. You know, doctors say that they're completely on their knees with this wave, and there's just no end to it. You know, the crematoriums are overwhelmed. There are hundreds of bodies coming in every day. You know, people are not being able to bury their dead for days. And it's really difficult to see the end of it. You know, the numbers are just going up and up and up, and people are just dying in their, you know, hundreds, in their thousands now.
And you're in Delhi, where the situation is terrible. Does it feel as if COVID is everywhere?
Yes, it feels like absolutely everyone has it. Everyone around me has it. You know, I'm recovering from it. It's everywhere. And, you know, tragically, I lost, you know, a really beloved colleague and friend this weekend to COVID. Karkali Bhattacharya, who was The Guardian's long-term news assistant and fixer, who'd worked with us for over a decade. And, you know, she was one of the most wonderful women that I knew in Delhi. She and I spoke every day. We worked closely together every single day. There wasn't a number she couldn't find. There wasn't a situation she couldn't smooth over. There wasn't a reporting job that she didn't make brilliant every time she went out with me. And, you know, she was 51 and she had two children. Last week, Karkali got COVID and her fever went up to 104 and it just wouldn't go down and her oxygen levels plummeted. She got admitted into hospital at the end of last week and on Saturday night, she died from COVID. And, you know, I'm utterly devastated. She still had so much of her life left to live. And I feel like, you know, this grief that I'm going through is a grief that's being reflected among almost everyone that I know. And it's really, really hard to know how to place it and what to do with it in this time.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, India's COVID tragedy. Hannah, I remember, as we all do, COVID-19 hitting for the first time early last year. The world was panicked and there was a lot of concern about a country like India because it has 1.3 billion people, overcrowded cities and real concerns about the healthcare system. How did Prime Minister Narendra Modi respond back then?
A lockdown was announced with 4 hours notice in March last year. And this lockdown was announced when cases in Delhi and cases in India were relatively low compared to what was happening in Europe and the US. Some people praised the lockdown and said it was a kind of very forward-thinking approach, but it ended up having a huge human cost. And the lack of notice that was given for the lockdown meant that millions of migrant workers who live and work in the cities, but are actually from rural villages across India, found themselves without any money, any ability to work. And these are people who live hand to mouth. They're called daily wage labourers. They live on what they earn that day and they have no savings. They have no homes a lot of the time. They live where they work.
Millions of them were left stranded with no jobs, money or food.
Interstate movement was banned.
Many were forced to walk hundreds of miles to their villages.
And thousands of people died by the roadside. There was no safety net given for these migrant workers. The story of India's COVID crisis in the first wave was very much one which wasn't even necessarily connected to COVID. It was the sort of human cost of lockdown.
And within that lockdown, which in public health terms, many might think was a good thing to do. As you say, there was a human cost. And we saw some pretty shocking pictures of police brutality as well.
Listen!
It was absolutely awful what the migrant workers were put through. Those who were trying to walk home because they had no alternative were beaten brutally by police. Some of them were sprayed with chemicals when they tried to go through state borders. And yet no safety net was put in place for them. And it's been since proved that actually the movement of the migrant workers was responsible for a huge amount of the spread of COVID in the first wave. You know, they were the ones who came from the urban centres into the rural areas and they spread the virus. So, you know, Modi gained some praise for implementing this strict lockdown, but there wasn't an enormous amount of kind of strategy that went into it.
And so clearly big questions about the severity of the lockdown by November. The rates were incredibly low. And the story, the narrative of India's COVID response appeared to be a positive one.
Yeah, I mean, and we were all very convinced by this. You know, the government by January was declaring victory on COVID. The BJP passed a resolution celebrating Modi's great defeat of COVID. The health minister was talking about how India has defeated COVID.
We have put up a valiant fight against the disease. We are on the verge of defeating the pandemic.
And when you talk about the response to that, I mean, I've got a lot of relatives in India and I saw plenty of action on WhatsApp, videos that I guess are from local news showing how amazing India had done and actually comparing it to basket cases as they were presented like the UK. Is that what it felt like?
Yeah, it did. It was a very seductive narrative. You know, I was drawn into it. Journalists would sit around and talk about Indian exceptionalism and say, you know, how astounding it was. And we were all very unsure of how it had happened, but we believed it to be true.
And did that change the way people behaved?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You still had to wear masks in public, but people were being so cavalier. And, you know, most people wore masks around their chin. People went to weddings, went to parties. You went into religious buildings and they were absolutely overflowing with people. That sense of worry about the virus, that sense of fear of the virus had completely disappeared. And I think that's the worrying thing, is that when that fear disappeared, everyone just took it very lightly. And it was stopping people getting the vaccine because people didn't really feel that sense of urgency. So there was very low vaccine take up initially. And doctors were saying it was because people didn't really think they needed to take it because COVID was gone.
And at that stage, when it looked like COVID was gone, what were the reasons being given? What range of explanations were people talking about as to why India might have bucked the trend so forcefully? Was it the early lockdown or was it something else?
Well, it's still a bit of a mystery as to the real reason, but there was all sorts of kind of ideas being speculated. There was a strong narrative that India had achieved the sort of nebulous concept of herd immunity, because particularly in cities like Delhi, people had been infected in such high numbers. And sero surveys were showing that, you know, almost 50% of Delhi had antibodies. There was this sense that somehow, because of the high rate of infectious diseases that circulates in India, because people have contact with so much pollution, that had somehow created a sort of natural immunity towards the virus that meant that people didn't get it quite so badly or weren't affected by it. And then there was just a lot of, I guess, just kind of optimism, which drove a lot of this. But, you know, you were speaking to a lot of kind of very well-respected healthcare officials or scientists or virologists who were perpetuating this idea that somehow India did have this kind of natural immunity.
The big question remains, are Indians more susceptible to contracting COVID-19 or has prolonged exposure to such conditions and pathogens given them sturdier immunity?
The people who were warning were doctors. You know, doctors from February were seeing cases going up and they were saying, you know, this virus hasn't gone away. This exceptionalism just doesn't exist. But, you know, these doctors were not listened to.
So given all of that, what did that mean when the whole world was gearing up for a second or third wave of COVID? What was the thinking in India at that point?
You can't deny that the cases did drop to spectacularly low levels. But the whole point here is that the sort of political leadership in every level, from the state governments, to the central governments, to medical boards, to the COVID task forces, all of them seized upon the optimism of that and decided that it had meant that India had defeated COVID. And after that point, turned a blind eye to any data that went against that narrative. And so in February, as the numbers were starting to rise, particularly in states like Maharashtra, you know, they were allowing the cricket to go ahead in the newly inaugurated Narendra Modi Stadium. And, you know, they didn't want it to happen without a crowd. So they allowed tens of thousands of people to gather for an England-India cricket match.
India struggling here.
People were cheering, jumping on top of each other, having a great time, as you do in sport. I mean, there's just no way to enforce social distancing in sport, particularly not in an Indian crowd watching cricket.
And if the optics were questionable for that, then they were arguably even worse, weren't they, for some of the religious festivals that were allowed to go ahead.
Yeah, so this was the sort of the most horrifying, the visuals are of the Kumbh Mela, which is this Hindu festival that's been happening for thousands of years. And the government allowed it to go ahead. And it's a festival that attracts millions of people who come and they gather on the shores of the Ganges and they go swimming in the Ganges. There were 10 million people who swam on one day who gathered at the Kumbh Mela.
Devotees from across the country have gathered for the Shahi Snan, which is taking place today at a time when COVID cases are at an all-time high, and ensuring social distancing has emerged as the biggest challenge for authorities.
And in fact, Modi was seen to have endorsed it. There was an advert of him on the front page, kind of wishing people to enjoy the Kumbh Mela. It was just another example of the government not actually being willing to make the tough choices this time round.
In fact, I've read reports that not only did the festival go ahead, but it had actually been moved forward from 2022, when it might have been safer, because this year was considered more auspicious. Now, we don't know yet what impact that had, or any of the other social mixing, but we do know that in COVID terms, things got really bad for India. Tell me what happened next.
The cases just went up at a rate that no one was prepared for. Suddenly, hospitals were completely overloaded. There were no beds left. There were people dying in ambulances outside hospitals. You know, people are just dying in hospital car parks. Doctors are on their knees trying to make room for patients, but there's just not nearly enough capacity.
We have to literally manage patients at home with oxygen, and this is not something we are enjoying.
Oxygen started to run out across Delhi and across the different states. In Madhya Pradesh, there are three hospitals and they've had to put signs saying no oxygen left. Doctors are having to fight legal battles to get the kind of basic needs.
Well, what would I do with the oxygen if it is not given in time?
They're trying to get some oxygen to patients while they can.
I need help. They were suffering.
I was speaking to this doctor in Mumbai and he put dozens of patients in the corridors. He's opened up the basement so that they can treat some patients there, but still not enough. And he said, and there are just people dying on the steps of my hospital every day, and there's nothing that I can do.
Balaji!
You know, I know four people who are in hospital, two of whom are in particularly really severe conditions. There are literally bodies lined up outside these crematoriums because people are queuing with their dead. People have to set up their own funeral pyres and they're burning their relatives in the car park because otherwise they have to wait days to do it. It's almost unfathomable, the tragedy, and it seems to have touched almost everyone that I know in Delhi.
It sounds like a war zone. Every conversation I have with loved ones about what is happening is heartbreaking. And within it, such a mix of ages being affected.
Yeah, so one of the sort of particularly haunting aspects of the second wave is that it's really impacting on young people, and it's young people that are in hospitals. You know, I've interviewed a man who his 22-year-old niece died from COVID in Lucknow. She is a mother of one, perfectly healthy, no pre-existing health conditions, but her oxygen started to dip to 50%, which is extremely low. And so he, you know, he's an ambulance driver. He knows people in the healthcare system, but he couldn't find her a hospital bed. And in the end, he had to buy her an oxygen cylinder himself. And he put her in the back of a car and he drove around to a dozen private and public hospitals, but he couldn't find anywhere that would take her. And so in the end, he found a private clinic, put her in this private clinic at, you know, great personal expense. It wasn't a COVID clinic. They just had some access to some oxygen. And they said, we'll take her for just for the night. And so he left her there and he went around desperately trying to find a bed for her that night, but he couldn't find one. Nowhere had any room in the Lucknow area. And so at 5 a.m., that clinic discharged her, and he had to take Deepti home, and she died a couple of hours later. And she was 22, and she was a mother of one. And he was in absolute despair. This is the reality of most people's situations.
Do we know why? Why are young people dying? Do we know statistically if it's definitely disproportionate, or is it just that everyone's getting COVID?
There's a real lack of kind of statistics at this point. But certainly, you know, the older generation are the ones who have got vaccinated. Young people were ones who went back out to work properly. They, you know, did a lot of socialising. They encountered each other when they had quite high viral loads. So they obviously getting the virus in a much kind of more severe ways.
And Hannah, one thing that usually happens in Indian society, I think it's fair to say, is that money can buy you better access to healthcare. But that doesn't seem to be the case right now.
No, you know, hospitals are full, and even the wealthy, you know, even MPs, politicians are struggling to find beds for their loved ones. You know, there was a transport minister that, you know, tweeted a plea that he couldn't find a bed. In West Bengal, where the elections have taken place, three candidates have died. There was an MP who did a live video from within a hospital saying, "My hospital has 3 hours of oxygen left," and he was there getting oxygen.
Request karta hu ki is tarike ki cheeze na kare.
Even the most powerful people in India are powerless against what is essentially the collapse of the healthcare system.
Do we know why it's so bad? Do we know whether it is all the social mixing, or is it anything to do with this new B.1.617 variant?
So at this stage, it's still difficult to say definitively why this is so bad and whether this is just because of complacency or whether it is because this new variant has emerged in India, this B.1.617 variant. So I was speaking to a very eminent Indian virologist, Dr. Shahid Jamil, who said that this variant does contain similar mutations to what we've seen in the Brazil and South African variant, which were obviously variants of great concern. These mutations are linked to increased transmittability and increased ability for the virus to evade natural immune protection. You know, we've seen the kind of sequencing so far has shown that this variant accounts for about 60% or up to 60% of the cases in Maharashtra. And, you know, as Dr. Shahid Jamil said, you know, if this variant is so responsible for the spread in Maharashtra, there's no reason to believe that it also isn't responsible for what's happening across India. Also, anecdotally, you know, from talking to so many doctors who are working on the front line, they're talking about a virus that is behaving differently, that, you know, is much more infectious, is much more virulent. You know, when one member of a family gets infected, almost invariably every other member of the family gets infected and is presenting with symptoms, which just isn't something that was happening last time when there were a lot more asymptomatic cases and the virus didn't seem to be spreading quite so fast. But certainly also, you know, the complacency, the lack of COVID protocols, the lack of social distancing, the enabling of weddings and gatherings and religious gatherings, you know, allowing people to go out to work, all of this, you know, allowed the virus to spread unimpeded. And so I do think it seems at this point that it is just a sort of combination of these two factors.
One thing I wanted to ask about is the AstraZeneca vaccine. I have two relatives who have had their first jab and yet, worryingly, tested positive for COVID-19. Now, I should say, first of all, that's totally anecdotal. But secondly, neither of them are too ill. So hopefully that is good news. But do we know whether the vaccine appears to be working, including against this new variant?
Well, it's really difficult to tell at this point. The Indian government has vaccinated a lot of people, but, you know, considering it's a population of 1.3 billion people, under 10% have received their first dose and only just over 1% have received both doses. So only a very small amount of the population is fully vaccinated against the virus. But older people who have had the vaccine do seem to not be getting sick.
How good is the data that is coming out of India? Do you have a proper sense of how bad things are?
Well, the thing that's become very apparent in the past couple of weeks is that the data isn't reliable. And, you know, you've even got senior virologists who are casting huge doubts on the data in terms of deaths in particular. And this is where huge kudos has to be given to Indian journalists who have been stationed outside of crematoriums across the country and are physically counting the dead, because the numbers of official dead are in no way matching up to the huge numbers that are coming into the crematoriums and graveyards and out of the hospital morgues. What we're hearing from those who are running the crematoriums, from those who are digging the graves, is that the deaths are possibly 10 times more than what official statistics are saying. It seems to be that state governments, particularly in Gujarat and Uttar Pradesh, are actively not reporting deaths and trying to downplay the catastrophe. You know, it's also not helped that people are finding it very difficult to get tests now. So people are dying without having even had a COVID test. So a distinct lack of data is also stopping India really being able to fight this properly.
Hannah, this all sounds completely terrifying and the speed of change is just astonishing. How is the government responding to this? How can they even start to get this under control?
The central government has been very slow to respond. Modi only stopped campaigning in West Bengal last Friday. He was holding huge political rallies there with, you know, hundreds, sometimes thousands of people. Hospitals have gone to the Delhi High Court and said, we've got a couple of hours left of oxygen. We need to do something. You know, they've agreed to listen to the case Tuesday, you know, by which point you can imagine how many people have died and how many hospitals will have run out of oxygen. You know, now there's orders such as, you know, all oxygen, which was previously for industry, now has to be for hospitals. The army has been brought in to protect oxygen tanks because there's so much thieving going on and they're actually seen as kind of at risk. There's new facilities being built across different states. Train carriages are being made into COVID facilities. The government has now said that from the 1st of May, vaccines will be opened up to anyone over the age of 18. But that doesn't solve the problem of the fact that there just aren't enough vaccines at the moment. You know, the Serum Institute have said that they aren't going to be able to produce any more vaccines until May or June. And meanwhile, there are people dying on the steps of hospitals.
Obviously, there were lots of reasons why a lockdown was seen as a terrible thing in India. It caused a lot of hardship. And in a country of that size, with such overcrowding, it was extremely difficult to do. But is the country now back into lockdown?
They're still introducing a policy of localised lockdowns. And Modi made a speech on Tuesday which said that he really didn't want to put the country back into a national lockdown.
The Prime Minister finally addressed the nation last evening.
हमें देश को लॉकडाउन से बचाना है.
He has urged the states to treat lockdown as the last resort.
कि वो लॉकडाउन को अंतिम विकल्प के रूप में ही इस्तेमाल करें.
A nationwide lockdown would be catastrophic. But currently, Mumbai is under a two-week lockdown. Delhi is under a lockdown until Monday. And it's widely thought that this will be extended because the situation here is so bleak.
Coming up, what this devastation means politically for Narendra Modi and his ruling BJP party. I mean, to be fair to the government, any government in a country like India, it's clearly an incredibly challenging issue. There's a population of 1.3 billion. The thing that they did the first time round, which was a very draconian lockdown that did appear to perhaps hold down cases, is completely devastating to the country in another way and was kept in place by examples of brutality by the police. But on the other hand, as you described, all these events went ahead that seemed crazy. Electioneering, rallies, huge cricket matches, and a religious festival that at one point had 10 million people there. To what extent do people think that Modi is to blame for what is happening? And what will this mean for him?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. You know, even just a few weeks back, I would have said that Modi's political popularity in India was almost untouchable. You know, he emerged from the last pandemic with an 80% approval rating for how he'd handled the pandemic. You know, in the past few months, he'd been celebrated as having led India out of this COVID crisis. You know, resolutions were passed celebrating Narendra Modi having helped defeat COVID. And now we've got this situation which no one seemed to have seen coming. And the government was totally unprepared for and didn't have the right resources. There isn't enough equipment. There isn't enough oxygen. And people can see that for themselves. And everyone is experiencing some kind of personal tragedy as a result of this. You know, outside of crematoriums, There are people wailing, saying, you know, Mr. Modi, where was my oxygen? Where was my hospital bed? You were out there trying to win elections, and my brother died. My mother died.
Nothing is being done. I don't know government is sleeping or what they are doing. I am totally disheartened in the situation which I am seeing. Government is a literal failure. A person cannot live here in Delhi. A person cannot even die peacefully in Delhi.
You know, 20 people died on Saturday in Jaipur Golden Hospital in Delhi because the hospital ran out of oxygen. Another 8 people died in Gurgaon hospitals on Sunday. You know, people are seeing for themselves and paying such a heavy price for the government's lack of preparation. And people are blaming the government and they are blaming Modi. And so I think, you know, the political implications of this on the Modi government will actually really be felt for a long time.
How worried do they seem to be?
The government is clearly very aware of this. There was an order made over the weekend for Twitter to remove dozens of tweets, which included those by lawmakers and ministers, which were critiquing the government's response. A lot of time, you know, from people's own experiences. And so the government ordered for Twitter to take down these tweets, which shows, you know, an interesting awareness of trying to do damage control for the narrative that is coming out of India, which is this was a government was completely underprepared for this devastating wave that is now happening.
And what does India's crisis mean for the rest of the world? Now it is absolutely desperate to increase its vaccine supply. Not long ago, it was a huge giver to the COVAX scheme that was getting vaccines into developing countries that hadn't had any. What does this mean for that?
Yeah, I mean, India's crisis is the world's crisis. You know, people were really relying on getting vaccine from the Serum Institute in India, which is a producer of the AstraZeneca vaccine. And the COVAX scheme was relying on the Serum Institute to produce almost 140 million doses of the vaccine. Now, there is no chance that India will be exporting vaccines anytime soon. And that is terrible news, particularly for its neighbours. The Serum Institute was supposed to be the supplier to the developing world.
If India's crisis is the world's crisis, what has been the international response?
So now that, you know, the gravity of India's situation is becoming so internationally apparent, you know, everyone's seeing the terrible images and stories that are coming out of India, you know, countries have begun to actually step up and offer assistance. So the UK sent 9 airplanes full of equipment, including ventilators, over the weekend. You know, Germany sent equipment, Singapore sent equipment. Pakistan has agreed to send some equipment, which, you know, is a very big deal. The US has agreed to send equipment, and the US has also agreed to lift an export ban on certain materials which are used to make the vaccine, which had apparently been hindering Indian vaccine makers' ability to amp up production. So that's very good in terms of India's vaccine. But yes, so it feels like the international community, whilst being quite slow initially, are now really stepping in.
And obviously, India's problem is the world's problem in another way as well. You know, the whole world is watching India with alarm, and not just because of what is happening there. There is also a huge fear of this wave spreading across borders, particularly if the new strain is shown to be more dangerous. We know a lot about this virus now, but it still seems to constantly surprise us. What can we learn from India's experience?
India's greatest mistake was complacency. And that, I think, is the ultimate lesson here. The virus won't go away on its own, and it has to be contained through strict measures and tough decisions. And complacency and naivety and optimism have really no place. And, you know, they're paying such a high price for that.
Hannah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Anushka.
That was Hannah Ellis-Peterson, The Guardian South Asia correspondent based in Delhi. She began by telling us about the tragic loss of The Guardian's news assistant, Karkali Bhattacharya, who was 51. Karkali had worked with Hannah, but also 3 previous correspondents, Michael Safi, Randeep Ramesh and Jason Burke. You can read their wonderful tribute to her on the website today. I'd also like to send our love to Karkali's family at this devastating time. You'll also have heard the shocking news that Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe has been sentenced to an additional year in prison and then a 1-year travel ban out of Iran because of yet more bogus charges. You can read the report from our diplomatic editor, Patrick Winter, and you can also listen to him and to Nazanin's husband, Richard Ratcliffe, on a Today in Focus episode back in March called Hostage Diplomacy: When Will Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe Be Free? I'm sorry that there is so much difficult news that I'm bringing you today. I do have one piece of good news. The Guardian documentary Colette has won an Oscar. Absolutely amazing work by the team who produced it. Well done to all of them. And you can watch it at theguardian.com. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Ned Carter-Miles. Sound design was by Ian Chambers. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.